So Remain in Light may be a familiar title for some listeners referencing a Talking Heads album. What's the link here?
The best person to ask would be George, the curator. But from my conversations with him, George and his partner Ron, who's an artist, Ron will title a lot of his artworks based on pop music, and also George will do that for exhibitions. So, and they basically absolutely love 1980s English and mostly English pop. And in fact, in my conversations with them, George and Ron said they never liked American music, and it was actually Talking Heads that really changed them to liking American music. But apart from that, it's essentially, so if we say, okay, we're getting a title from pop music, and then Remain in Light just references photography and its relationship to light.
I read in your essay that the Talking Heads album, this one, was their kind of drive away into, like, to leave the conventions of a regular group and kind of involving, like, communal creation in the album. How do you see that reflected in Remain in Light, the exhibition?
Well, I think it's a similar methodology. And it's quite interesting when you read up on Remain in Light. You know, they'd become quite a successful group out of the New Wave movement. But the other members of the group were really pissed off with David Byrne and were actually, I think it was the drummer and bass player, Tina Weymouth, were going to quit and saying, like, he basically, it's like a job and he's the boss and he tells us what to do. And he writes the lyrics and we just, you know, write music around it. We're like his backing group. So there was a lot of tension. And they were essentially saying, we're going to quit and go off and do our own thing. So it became a crisis point. And they really sat down and talked about it and said, okay, what do you want to do? And they said, well, we want to just improvise and experiment. And let's just start playing music and recording it and seeing what comes out of that. And then you can write lyrics around that. And even actually David Byrne came around to that. And it became, you know, there were some big hits off that record, but some of the lyrics he would just kind of free associate, or he was, I know, you know, there's the big hit was Once in a Lifetime, and a lot of the lyrics from that came from listening to, I don't know if it was radio or television, but it was one of those Christian broadcasts, you know, where a preacher was saying, oh, you know, like, what's going to happen in your future, and, you know, what could go wrong in your life. Also, yeah, how it relates to the exhibition, that's kind of how George curates. You know, it was a bit shocking for me when I went in and he said, oh, I want you to write something about the exhibition. I'm going, great, what's it all about? And he goes, oh, well, there's actually no theme. I just pick artists who I like and I like their work and I bring it all together. And, like, it's kind of your job as a writer to put it together. And I thought, and then when I started Remain in Light, I was like, okay, he's working in a similar way to how Talking Heads did. And, like, I think that's good, you know, that we don't have to be rational all the time. You can actually bring intuition into it and just go, look, this just feels right. I think I'll do it. And then we make sense of it later on.
Do you think that, you know, you said you're the one who kind of had to draw the connections. Do you think George knows that that's how he works, like, in a similar way?
Yeah, well, because also, you know, I don't just sit there and write all this and say, hey, I've figured you out, you know, like, I've analysed you. So I kept coming back to him going, oh, I'm thinking about going in this direction and I've learned this and I've learned that. And He always agreed with it. In fact, I put a little quote from an email we had in the text where he said, yeah, like, I do like to sort of improvise and just bring it all together. And then actually it's in how he installs the work as well. You know, the kind of the flow of the exhibition that hopefully as a viewer you come in and piece together some whole from it.
It's also part of the intelligence of, you know, his curatorial style, is that he doesn't need to articulate those things. It's the choices that he makes and the way that he kind of intuits how one work or how one artist can really bounce off and relate to another. You know, he's very skilled at that.
Yep.
And, you know, I think the articulation of that through text, for him, he doesn't necessarily need to sort of, sort of prove why he's doing it.
Mm.
He's very skilled at it. And, you know, the friction of those artists come together, you don't often see what it's going to be like until they're in the room and the artists, you know, have installed the work and they're up there, and then those ideas that are probably in the back of his mind or in some sort of intuitive level he's trying to, you know, aim towards will, you know, be achieved. It's very exciting in those moments.
Speaking about, you know, the connection between artists and seeing how they interact in the space, you also wrote about how like a group exhibition reveals something about our era, especially this one being about photography. What do you feel that may have been revealed for you, at least? in seeing it all come together.
Mm. Yeah, and I actually think it'd be wonderful if there was something like, you know, if an institution like the Archive of New South Wales bought that exhibition complete and just kept it together, and then in 20 years' time, you know, you could represent it, because often that's when you make sense of a time. But what I like about it in researching that exhibition is it's, you know, it's quite political. You know, like some of the artists are referring to economic and social conditions. And then other people, and I guess my overall thesis in the paper was, if I was going to encapsulate what everyone's doing, is they're really questioning, you know, a lot of things in photography we tend to take for granted. So some are questioning the medium in itself and what we think a photograph should be about, and other people are questioning its uses in those social and economic contexts.
Speaking about questioning, we'll talk about your work, John, and you, your images, you have three works, and they aim to challenge the conventions that underpin landscape photography. So can you tell us about how you've done that?
Well, I suppose for me, landscape, the term landscape refers to all matter and phenomena in the known universe. So it was a pretty broad subject matter, but it's, you know, we just happen to be in this time and space where landscape is a hill or a tree or a space that we, you know, inhabit, or we're going through, or there's a trajectory of that. But what I'm really interested in is sort of pulling apart the material nature of what reality is and looking at the questions of time and space, matter, sort of macro, micro of that. And, you know, photography, landscape photography is very bedded down in capturing what I suppose is this idea of the epic sublime, or the, you know, something in nature that we respond to, whether it's fear or joy or something. But for me, I need to try and sort of, my questions are more about going behind what's there and what's, you know, the nature of reality itself. And because, you know, when you are in these places, you're looking at this incredible landscape and you feel something, you have, you know, we keep going back to the term intuition, you know, you feel this intuition about what's happening in front of you. But then if you start reading, you know, ideas about time and or quantum physics or the nature of material, you realize it's something else quite different. And this sort of phenomena is happening. And, you know, it's sort of our interpretation of that, what we're seeing. So what I'm really trying to do with these, like I use a lot of scanners and, you know, like cameraless photography, I suppose, is the term people use, where you're just using capturing devices. And for a lot of that work, the idea is to make those capturing devices fail to see what the artifact is. So, you know, if you're pushing a device like a scanner beyond its limits, like with the video work, I just smashed a number of scanners and completely destroyed them until our sort of circuits were coming out, and we're still being able to use the scanning wand, or, you know, the imaging device. And the more and more aberrations come through, these things, you know, are artifact of the phenomena, or this is what I see as them being sort of outcomes of the phenomena that's happening, rather than what we just perceive or see through an image.
Totally. having your work be cameraless, how do you think that fits into the context of an exhibition that explores photography and its bounds?
I suppose, well, cameraless photography, I mean, it's a tricky term because, I mean, I do also use cameras. So, you know, I use film and digital and scanners and iPhones and everything. It's just about a way that light can bounce off an object and go through something else, which is a medium like a scanner or an image, to be able to capture something that I'm looking at. So, the idea of cameraless photography has been around for a very long time, and it's really about trying to push past the kind of accepted norms of what a lens can do and what you're looking at and what this sort of simple transference of the image into the camera is. It's about trying to look at something a bit deeper, or something that's perhaps felt when you're in that space.
Awesome. Just to finish, Michael, in your essay, you brought up Google's work in producing aesthetically pleasing landscape photos via machine learning. Yeah. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so this is something that's just been going on for the last couple of years. And it's interesting, when I look into it, I think maybe Google is like the biggest photography studio and company in the world today, that we don't really think about them as being a photography company. But they've got so much data from Street View. And it's not just pictures of, you know, houses and office buildings. Sometimes they're going through country areas that they get lots of pictures of mountains and trees and lakes. And for whatever reason, I mean, you think, well, like, why do they get these ideas? They're going, oh, can we make beautifully aesthetically pleasing landscape photographs that someone who loves landscape photography would look at and go, that's really wonderful, but have it all made by a computer. So they actually, there is some photography internet forum where they do competitions, I think every week or every couple of weeks, and people upload photographs and then they all vote on each other. So in fact, Google have this amazing database available to them that's publicly available of just what humans think is a really good landscape photograph. And so then they get the algorithm to analyze all of that and go, can we break it down into composition, light, color, etc., in a way that this algorithm can then understand that as a model and go, okay, that is what people think is a really good landscape photograph. Then it goes and trawls through their amazing database of street view images and then finds ones that are likely candidates, but then it will merge multiple pictures together, do HDR, change the color, and make a totally new photograph. And they actually tested it by getting people who are regarded as, you know, experts in landscape photography and showing them maybe 20 or 30 photos, some of which were made by their artificial intelligence, some of which were human-taken landscape photographs. And, you know, a lot of their artificial images received quite high ratings.
Wow, that's very scary.
Yeah, it is quite incredible, you know, and I think exhibitions like Remain in Light are very interesting, you know, for what artists are doing and thinking about where photography is going. But then you've got these multinational digital corporations that are actually off doing their own thing that is actually quite interesting as well. But then you go, at least with an artist, we know why they're doing it. You know, you can talk to John and he can articulate what his idea and what his rationale is. And you go to Google, what are you trying to do here?
Yeah. You know, like, what are they trying to do? It's kind of almost funny because, like, they're manipulating photography as much as everyone is in Remain in Light, but it's like, yeah, what's your intention?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing, because I find it really interesting. And I think, you know, if you're going to create images like that through those processes, it's just another way, because someone is behind that. So there's someone, you know, organizing and orchestrating those things to happen. So it's like an extension of, I suppose, an artist in one sense. Yeah. I'm quite happy for those things to happen. It's just, you're right, the kind of intention or what that agenda is behind that, what's its use?
Yeah.
It's always a thing in question.
But I think, too, that's what makes photography so interesting, that it's not this static, dead medium, that as technology changes, you know, like we've seen in the last 5 or 10 years, photography is so radically transformed by digital technology, but then by the way we can just share so much these days. And it'd be sad if photography was just like still stuck in the past. But so in some ways it can be a bit frightening, but it's also exciting to go, this is this medium technology that's so totally alive. And it can be anything to anyone.
It's probably one of the most alive art forms, and it's also the most accessible. Like, anyone can take a photo anytime.
Yeah.
I think it's, yeah.
And there's more photographers now than ever in history.
And I think it doesn't really, like, achieve much to kind of, like, put it on a pedestal and be like, oh, everyone, like, that's not the same, because I guess, like, it is the same. I mean, you don't have to get all, like, I don't know, like, pretentious about it. Like, oh, everyone can take a photo. It's, like, not important, but it all kind of plays a part now.
I think the proliferation of images is something that's really unknowable for us at the moment as artists, because in a very short period of time, the access to images has just gone exponential. And so every person who has, you know, that sort of access to an internet can see billions of images in very short periods of time. So it's sort of very difficult to work out what that's actually doing to our psyche and the way that we process looking at photographs. And, you know, so does that mean that photographs are less, because, you know, there's this oversaturation and we've seen virtually every corner of the earth, except for a few. I mean, and we had an exhibition, I run a gallery at Melbourne called C3, and we had an exhibition by an artist who was working in Senegal, and they were in an area where Ebola was happening, and there was no tourists there, there was no reporters, no nothing, and her photographs were images that I've never seen before of these places. And it was just interesting because, you know, the social construct of people being able to be somewhere then opens up the images, and then those images become free onto the internet, and then everyone gets to see them, and so you've sort of seen everything or every image. And so what was so shocking about her images were there were places on the world that no one had really seen before. They were really, you know, undocumented because it was such a poor, out of the way place with so much disease going on, so people didn't want to go there. You know, and it's, I think as photographers, we really need, or people working with photographers, because I wouldn't call myself a photographer, I'm an artist, but I just use imaging as one of my, because I also make sculpture and drawing and video, And, you know, we need to kind of reconcile what this proliferation of images is going to do for us in the, you know, the next, this next process of, or the next phase of art making. Because I think it's unknowable, you know, what that means.
I hope it's an exciting sense of unknowing, though.
Well, I think that's why, you know, like robots making art is fantastic, because it's, you know, if we're seeing every single image on the planet and we're sort of having this proliferation of imagery, which kind of then does change the way we perceive that, then maybe something which is out of our perception, like a robot or a program making an image that's thing, is something, you know, is really, is a new step or is an interesting step. I'm quite intrigued by it, actually.